Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to Edgy Ideas. My special guest today is Martin Parker. Martin is Professor of Organizational Studies at the School of Management, Bristol University. He is also the lead for the Inclusive Economy Initiative. His training is in sociology, anthropology, and cultural studies. Martin challenges conventional thinking on management and organizations, and his recent books include Life After COVID-19, Anarchism, Organization and Management, and Shut Down the Business School. Other books focus on utopianism, conspiracy theory, business ethics, and alternative organizations. Martin, a very warm welcome to Edgy Ideas podcast. How are you this morning?
I'm lovely. Thank you, Simon. Thanks for asking me.
Good. It's a real pleasure. I've followed your work for a while, Martin, and we share an interest in anarchism and organizations. And I wonder if you'd like to just share with our listeners what you think anarchism has to do with management and organizations.
Of course. I think lots of people would think that anarchism and management are somehow opposed, that, you know, management's about control and anarchism is about disorganization or something. And I think that's far from the truth. I'm interested in lots of different ways in which people can think about organization. And most business schools tend to have a very narrow conception of what they mean by organization. They tend to study large corporations and the state. Anarchists for the last 200 years have been encouraging us to think about organization in some much more generous and interesting ways, questioning the need for authority, for hierarchy, for status, and thinking about questions of decision making and all the rest of it. So to me, anarchism is a very interesting and historically long lasting way of thinking about organizing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of my work and writing really has been informed by social movements, which again are informed by much of anarchist kind of thinking and practice, actually. I mean, the interesting thing about anarchism is that it doesn't just theorize, it actually enacts and practices. So social movements have really made massive changes in society. They are the leading forces of change from where I'm sat.
And that's right, yeah. I mean, I think it's really easy for us to get kind of fixated on a particular set of formal organizations and imagine that they're the kind of key actors in the world. And they're not always, you know, it's kind of important what Amazon or the United States of America does, but it's certainly not the only thing that changes the world.
That's right. And the whole kind of field of leadership, which we're both interested in, is there's a hagiography around kind of messiah leaders and individuals and charismatic individuals. And actually kind of how change happens is often from the edges. And even in social movements, if you look at like Martin Luther King, people kind of put him on a pedestal, and rightly so in some ways, because he's obviously a brilliant leader and orator. But there's a whole social movement behind Martin Luther King, which often gets kind of marginalized.
Absolutely. I think that's right. And I mean, one of the things that the hero leader does is to make the rest of us assume somehow that we can't be heroes or leaders, isn't it? We just sort of wait for somebody to lead us. And that seems to be a really disabling way of thinking about your lives and also about politics and about the ways in which we might engage with it. You know, for me, everybody is a leader. The question is whether they have any kind of power to effect change.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, leadership, hierarchies and leadership really do create a kind of dependency culture, which of course suits elite power groups. I mean, elite power groups want dependent cultures to kind of do the work and not question things, because the leaders are the ones who are supposed to know. So it feeds that kind of a dependency, subservient way of thinking, doesn't it?
That's right. Exactly. It does. Yeah. It's almost as if you've got a sort of an account of insufficiency for most people, isn't it? So there are certain people who are leaders, and then the rest of us who can't be, you know, that we just have to wait for Messiah to come along and then we'll follow them.
That's right. And I mean, what's interested me in my early days, before we went on the podcast, I was telling you, I grew up in Bristol in the 80s, where there was lots of riots and anarchists were demonstrating against Thatcherism and stuff. And it was a very lively place. And in those days, I believed in that all leadership and authority could be abolished, you know, the old anarchist shouts. But being part of these groups and observing feminist groups and anarchist groups and social movements, I noticed that there was actually lots of power games being played, lots of leadership taking place in the shadows. And I wonder what you think about that.
I think that's right. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting work on this, isn't there, in terms of the way in which hierarchies emerge within supposedly flat groups and so on. Some of this stuff is then interpreted to say somehow that organizations with leaders are a more natural form or something, that, you know, what you get is an account of the decay of anarchist, feminist, more egalitarian organizational forms into something which is hierarchical. And then that's kind of associated with ideas about human nature or something.
Yeah.
I don't quite buy that account. I mean, I think that the question really is how coordination happens in non-managerial settings, isn't it? Because any form of organizing, any group, is going to have mechanisms that allow it to coordinate its complicated activities. That doesn't necessarily mean those mechanisms have to be hierarchical, but they do need to be thought about. They need to be actively considered. You can't simply assume that everybody will know how to make decisions. You have to discuss this stuff. And that's what anarchism does, isn't it? It makes us aware of the ways in which we construct rules together.
That's right. And, I consult to many kind of organizations, from not-for-profit social movements to the large corporate banks, and it's interesting that the large corporate banks, the global corporations and tech companies, they're actually trying to borrow from anarchist ideas and social movement ideas. They're actually, they realize that they have to, at some level, give people more autonomy, try and allow people to take up leadership at the edges of the organizations, because they know that they can't control everything from the center anymore. So they try and do this tightrope walk where they try and use a rhetoric and a language of kind of freedom and autonomy, and that everyone can be leaders, and at the same time hold on to kind of central power. And it's kind of interesting to watch that.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of contemporary organizations are kind of talking about this idea of empowerment and decentralization and all the rest of it. But the real clue is in questions of ownership and control, isn't it? So, you know, if the organization is still substantially owned by a bunch of shareholders and run by a bunch of senior managers, then it doesn't matter how much they talk about empowerment. Essentially, they hold the cards.
They do, yeah. And they hold the cards until the pack of cards collapses. And I think that's the interesting thing at the moment. We're at a point where the pack of cards is collapsing in different ways. We have kind of populism. We have the rise of China. We have kind of COVID-19. We have Black Lives Matter. There's a lot going on. And there's a lot of anxiety, not only in social circles, but also in business circles.
That's right. I mean, it seems that everywhere you look, there's a crisis, isn't there? You know, whether that's a crisis in terms of the legitimacy of the state, or of our, you know, inequalities in our current economic arrangements, or COVID, or climate, or whatever else. It's almost as if we're surrounded by problems. And in a sense, though there's nothing to be desired in that, that does stimulate enormous amounts of creativity and people thinking more fundamentally, I think, about the nature of the economic and social systems that we live in.
That's right. And then the business movement, there's a lot of talk in the business movement about kind of reform and good capitalism and B Corps and how we can do things better. And at the same time, of course, they want to hold on to their profits and their power. Are you a reformist or a revolutionary, Martin?
I'm a revolutionary mostly. I mean, I'm not sure I'd go for the simple version of either reform or revolution. Right. But yeah, more revolution than reform, if you like. I'm very skeptical about a lot of this sort of purpose-driven capitalism stuff. It seems very often that if you read a lot of this literature, it's almost like all the kind of the structures in terms of, you know, shareholding and power and managerial privilege, the rest of it stay the same, but they promise to be good. you know, and I just don't really buy that. Yeah. We look back, you know, the obvious analogy here is the banks, isn't it? So, you know, 2008, we had massive financial crisis, all sorts of talk about regulating the banks, which never transpired, and lots of banks promising to be good, but basically not altering their business models one jot. And now, you know, a decade later, we're in exactly the same position and nothing has changed in terms of the structure of finance. And that seems to me a really tragic example of the ways in which people can be bought off by these kinds of promises. You know, if somebody kept on lying to you about change, then after a while, you're not going to believe them. So I don't see why we should believe those people who assert that capitalism with purpose can somehow save us.
No, that's true. And in my book on leadership and my writing about eco-leadership, I talk about the coming together of like the big six consultancies, the business schools and the corporations. They kind of feed each other with the right rhetoric and you know, the corporations pay the business schools kind of for their very high feed MBAs and sending people on the courses and the consultancies. There's like a circular kind of economy going on between those three. And your book raised some of those questions on shut down the business school. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this was a kind of book that was a long time coming, and it sort of puts together a whole series of my complaints about what goes on in terms of business school teaching and research. And I guess the quick summary is that I think that business schools are really dangerous places in terms of the way in which they reproduce a set of very conventional assumptions about what capitalism is and does. So I kind of suggest that what we should be doing is teaching organizing in a much more general sense, which of course would include anarchism as we explored at the start. But the idea of teaching organizing is to kind of, if you like, pull us away from this set of assumptions that managerialism is the one best way, that corporations are the best organizational form and so on. Because essentially, that's what the 13,000 business schools on the planet do. They just kind of tell a series of fables about a dying economic system. And I think that's a really dangerous message to be selling.
Yeah, I agree. I was really shocked. I mean, I came into the world of business schools from a background of working in a factory, being a family therapist, being a psychotherapist. So I came in from a public sector culture, and I walked into a business school to study, to do a PhD.
Right.
And I was completely and utterly shocked by what I read and what was taken for normal. It was like, I think I must have been very naive. I was just absolutely shocked by the way the rhetoric and the repetitive kind of models were just kind of repeated with new fads and just how manipulative they use psychology, the way it was used to kind of change management behavior, as if managers were kind of cogs in the wheel of the machine still. Mm-hmm. The whole kind of rhetoric was a shock to me. And then I came across critical kind of management studies, which helped a bit, but a lot of that is also in a kind of an elite place, isn't it? It distanced itself from what goes on the ground, I think.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I've been involved with critical management studies pretty much since it started about 25 years ago now, I guess. And in retrospect, I think it's played all the same kind of academic games. You know, it's about, you know, finding some obscure theorist and then writing a journal article about them and so on.
Yeah.
And that sort of position, I mean, I was very positive about the idea of this sort of internal critique of the business school. And in some sense, I'd still defend that. But in terms of its impact on the world outside, I think it's really been minimal. You know, I think it's ended up as a kind of conversation between a series of pointy heads debating whether it should be Marx or Foucault. And I don't see how that's really, you know, changed the world very much.
No, I mean, I agree. And that's why I left the business school. I work kind of in practice, and that the kind of theory and practice piece is very important to me. And, you know, I'm very grateful for critical theory because it really helps me think about things. But I don't think the critical theorists do enough about kind of building back better. They're very good at critiquing and sharing the critiques. But how we actually make the changes, I think there's still quite a naivety around that.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, my sense is that for quite a lot of academics, this is a general problem. So, you know, in the social sciences, arts, humanities, and so on, there's this sort of idea that if you've written a journal article about something, that somehow that's, you know, a form of politics. And it is, but only in a tiny way, you know, that there's this curious sort of sense that lots of academics have that their paper games matter to the world outside. And I just don't think they do. No, and that nobody reads our tiny comics, our obscure language, or cares about, you know, the various spats that happen between different theorists. So there really is a job of work to be done, I think, in terms of opening up the university in order that it can be useful for a bunch of people to help them think about their situations.
And is that what you're doing in Bristol now? You're doing a piece of work outside the university with your ideas. Is that what you're trying to do?
That's what I'm trying to do, Simon. Yeah, I mean, since I arrived in Bristol, one of my motivations for coming to Bristol was because there are so many interesting economic experiments here. There's lots of, you know, co-ops and mutuals and green business networks and all sorts of fascinating stuff going on. So what I'm trying to do with as much time as I've got available to me is to be a sort of connector between academics in the social sciences mostly and a whole series of the projects in the city, trying to think about ways in which we can be helpful to that sort of stuff. And that means, I think, thinking differently about academic research. I'm not the only person to have said this, but basically the idea is that instead of taking our problems to the world and asking the world to answer them, we go to the world and find out what its problems are and then try to help the world answer those. So that's a very different way of thinking about power relations and research. And it's leading to some really interesting networks now. So, you know, I'm reasonably well connected with a bunch of people doing, you know, inclusive stuff and green stuff across the city, and getting better at trying to plug the academics at the University of Bristol into that stuff. And that's, you know, it's a pleasure to do that kind of work, but I'm also really hoping it has some impact.
Yeah, and actually, like you say, you learn a lot from it, don't you? I mean, it informs your theories. It's not like you going in as the expert and telling people what the game is. It's actually, you really, I mean, your background in anthropology helps out. I mean, I always think about myself as an anthropologist when I go into an organization, because you just soak up kind of knowledge, don't you? You kind of observe and you really learn from that experience.
There's a funny thing going on there, isn't there? So on the one hand, sometimes I have to deliberately downplay the fact I come from the university, because there are lots of people in the city who are very suspicious of Bristol University with all its kind of elite pretensions and its slave-owning past and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, these are difficult issues. So sometimes it's better that I just sort of kind of, you know, downplay the professorship and all the rest of it. On other occasions, it's really helpful that I've got that, because sometimes for small organizations in the city, they want to be associated with big, powerful institutions in order that they can, you know, get legitimacy and perhaps get help getting research grants or whatever else. So there's a kind of, there's both a kind of problem and an opportunity in coming from the university into very often these very small organizations.
Yeah, and I meet a lot of people in social movements and also in the business world where there's a big skepticism about kind of academics and theory. But I always are, you know, I say you're absolutely right and you've got good reason to be. But I also say I'm not ashamed of trying to kind of understand things better. I'm not ashamed of really trying to develop theories. We actually really need, at this moment in history, we really need some deep thinking as well, rather than just some superficial thinking.
I think that's right. So then the question is, you know, who's the thinking for, isn't it? So there's plenty of examples of very smart and complex academic theory that's basically designed to be consumed by other academics.
Yeah.
And that's a very specialist practice, you know, a very particular way of thinking. And I'm more interested in how forms of thought, complex, difficult forms of thought, might gain some purchase on the world outside.
Yeah, and that's a real challenge. And I think people like Bruno Latour are very interested in that. They really clearly very deep philosophers and deep thinking, but do try and kind of think about climate change and think about kind of issues on the ground and what makes sense on the ground beyond
that's the right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, Latour is an interesting example of somebody who's kind of turned, in a sense, turned away from particularly obscure forms of social theory and towards matters of contemporary concern. And I think, you know, climate change is the big leveler in all of this, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter who you are or where you are on the planet, it's going to affect you in one way or another. And obviously those impacts are going to be differentiated in some predictable ways, but it matters to everybody. Yeah. And that's a kind of an existential question for the human species, and something that really should be encouraging us to think about universities as having a particular responsibility in this, in terms of encouraging forms of thought and action that can hopefully stave off massive crisis.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, when I go into organizations to talk about eco-leadership, it's interesting because I'm not just talking about environmental leadership, I'm talking about ecosystems and networks and their stakeholder networks. And they realize that this is not a split off thing. It's not kind of environment good, kind of business bad. I'm not arguing that case. You know, I can argue that case, but I'm actually saying to them, like, you know, if you want to run a successful business, you have to understand this stuff as well. Like, you know, we don't live in the 20th century. We don't live in kind of a machine kind of a world anymore. We live in a world of networks, and you have to kind of get beyond this. And it's the same kind of way of thinking to resolve the climate crisis. It's not different. If you want to kind of be adaptive in your business and survive these big crises we face, you have to kind of understand the networks in which we live and the ecosystems in which we live.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So very often, I think business has been imagined as a kind of a discrete and competitive practice, hasn't it? And so, you know, when you're measured by the number of stores, the number of customers, the number of countries you operate in, or whatever it is. And we desperately need, as you're saying, I think, now to understand business as being part of much wider ecosystems. And consequently, it must be shaped by and be respectful of its impact on those ecosystems. And any form of business practice that doesn't take that seriously will just have to go. It's got to end. I mean, as we're clearly seeing now with the idea of stranded assets and oil companies.
Yeah, and it's not just business. It's the large public sectors. It's the health sector, the education sector. They're all kind of part of this. It's not just kind of them over there. It's kind of us as well. You know, small businesses, large businesses. But the whole idea of organizing, as you say, is at the heart of this. Can you say a bit more about organizing and your thoughts on it?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think for me, management is one particular form of organizing. And in saying that, I'm kind of positioning the idea of organizing as being a really fundamental characteristic of human beings as a species. We're organizing creatures, yeah, in that we connect people and things together in order to achieve, you know, remarkable outcomes, whether that's, you know, building bridges or making the internet, whatever it might be. So organizing is clearly important, but that doesn't tell us anything in itself about the characteristics of different forms of organizing in different contexts. So the danger of the business school for me is that it assumes that a particular form of organizing, market managerialism, is the best one to aim at a whole series of different sorts of problems. So in the case of, you know, we've just been talking about climate crisis, the idea that capitalism with purpose can be low carbon is precisely an outcome of that sort of thinking. Yeah, the idea that managerialism, if it's only a bit kinder, can somehow get us out of the hole we're in. I just don't buy that stuff. And I kind of assume that we should be treating organizing as a very wide toolkit of ways that we can think about gluing ourselves and non-humans together in order to produce particular kind of outcomes. So we need much more creativity and innovation from our young people. And that's what we should be teaching them in schools, in business schools, not how to reproduce what we've already got, but rather how to imagine futures that you and I probably won't be living in.
Yeah, and you said schools before business schools. I think schools precisely. I think the whole kind of factory industrial kind of education system is still so outdated. It's kind of beyond me, really, how we teach our children. We put them through these institutions. It's just really not fit for purpose anymore. And a business school is kind of one, like the end of that, the end result of that. But primary schools. the whole education system, I think, really needs to, really question how it teaches, how people learn, what's needed for the future.
That's right. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, going back to anarchism, there are many really interesting examples of kind of anarchist ways of thinking about education, aren't they? Rather than stressing obedience and discipline, would instead think about kind of creativity, responsibility, obligations to others, all that kind of stuff. And I think those sorts of ideas then start to look potentially much more promising in producing human beings who will be capable of living in the sort of new economy that I'm imagining.
Yeah, and beneath all this, though, there's something about power or how things are held together, because, like, we have good examples of education. So if you go to Finland, I think it has one of the best education systems in the world by all kind of measures, and they don't have any homework, they have a lot more self-learning, you know, they're far more advanced in kind of that way of thinking. And yet, like in Ireland and in America and different places, they just stick to the same old system. So there's a reason why they stick to the same old system. I wonder what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of inertia to lots of organizational forms, whether they're education or businesses or business schools, indeed. You know, once something's been established, it has a kind of, well, what some academics would call a sort of path dependency to it. You know, that it's almost like it sort of sets and particular sorts of choices seem like they're unavailable. And I think we need to kind of unset a lot of our organizations in order that we can reimagine them in different ways. You know, there's that famous, I can't remember who it is now, is it Kurt Lewin or someone like that? The change, what is it? And freeze and refreeze. Yeah, that thing. Who is that?
Kurt Lewin, yeah.
That is Lewin, yeah. Yeah, so we kind of need to do that on a massive scale, don't we? You know, to kind of, to reimagine what we think the purpose of a whole set of social institutions might be.
I think so, yeah. And I think, you know, I think business had to rethink it. It's no good kind of just jigging at the edges. They had to rethink the whole idea of value. You know, I think society has to think about the whole idea of work. What does work mean? We assume that work means a 9-to-5 kind of office job or factory job, or that's how it's been conceptualized. But that's a very recent invention, isn't it?
Well, it is. That's right. But I mean, it's a really important one. And it's one that, you know, COVID is beginning to undo in part, isn't it? So our cities, our transport systems, our food systems are all arranged around this idea that, you know, people leave their little rabbit hutches at 8 or 9 in the morning and then go into the centre of the city or into the industrial park, whatever it is, do their work and then come home again. University of Bristol is a case in point. You know, it's got a campus, fairly central in the city, and thousands of employees who cycle and drive in there on a daily basis. Now, the University of Bristol has been functioning, not particularly well, but it's been functioning off kitchen tables across the whole southwest of England. Yeah. So there's real questions, I think, for lots of organisations now about whether they need to organise time and space in the same ways that they have historically assumed that they have to.
That's right, and with technology and AI and new developments, I just think we're really going to have to kind of broaden the idea of work. So, I mean, for a long time, feminists have argued it to be broadened into the domestic sphere, and then there's talk about universal incomes where everybody gets a wage. And I really think these ideas are for now, you know, not for a decade ahead. They really are for now, where we actually think about kind of how work gets divided up in different ways. And some people kind of work less, some people work at home, some people kind of do different types of work, which is not at the moment remunerated.
That's right. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, our assumptions about work, we basically inherit from the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And, you know, never mind the technology, we can talk about social relations, can't we? So, you know, in the crudest Marxist sense, there's a bunch of people who profit and a bunch of people who sell their labour. Yeah. Some of the changes that we're going to require are changes in ownership and control of that labour. Because at the moment, we still live in an economy, global economy, that's dominated by some extraordinarily large organisations. You know, the one I keep on banging on about, obviously, is Amazon. So, you know, the personal fortune of Jeff Bezos increased by Christ knows how many $billions during COVID, largely because Amazon has its finger in so many different pies, whether it's, you know, delivering us food and books or providing us with TV to watch. So we're seeing massive global concentrations of power and wealth. I don't think that's the way in which we're going to solve the problems that face us.
No, and whilst I admire the vision and the entrepreneurship of some people who kind of see the opportunities of the network society, it's about rethinking value. So we don't just have value as kind of measures of profit or shareholder value. We have to kind of find social value and reward social value kind of in a different way. And when it gets kind of just placed into one individual or a small group of shareholders, it's actually, I think that people are realizing that it's going to create so much social division and it really doesn't address the problems, that it's going to really, it really does have to be questioned.
That's right. Well, if we take, you know, another contemporary issue, so Black Lives Matter, you know, one of the very clear pieces of data that's coming out right the way across the global north is that the people who suffer most from COVID are those who are already at the bottom of the heap. Yeah. So people have to go to work in care homes and taxis and all the rest of it, or who live in overcrowded accommodation or have inadequate food, whatever it might be. So those kinds of questions about social justice and distribution aren't going to go away just because we've got successful corporations. Yeah, these are questions about fairness and the way in which we imagine the values of our society.
Yeah, and you know, immigrant workers in COVID, I mean, the clusters of COVID outbreaks around immigrant kind of farm workers and factory workers in Leicester is those people who are really kind of most oppressed really get hit worst, and COVID really amplifies that, as well as Black Lives Matter. Both come together in a way, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. There's the author Arundhati Roy has this nice sort of way of arguing. I think the metaphor she used was COVID's a bit like a kind of an etching fluid or an acid that allows you to see the bones of the social more clearly. You know, so yeah. If you look at, say, distribution of deaths, for example, then, you know, pretty much that's a fairly good indicator of social class. Yeah. So, you know, without understanding that kind of stuff, we're not really going to get very far in terms of changing the societies that we're part of.
Absolutely. Do I recall, Martin, that you wrote about pirates at one stage?
I did. That's right. Yeah, about a decade ago, I got really interested in the kind of ways in which different forms of crime were also a form of business. Yeah, so I wrote about pirates and outlaws and Robin Hood and a whole series of things. Yeah, it was kind of, I very often get fascinated with things that fascinated me when I was a kid. Yeah. So this was just an excuse for me to kind of, you know, to think about a whole load of glamorous outlaws, really. But also, you know, the serious point was to say that very often what outlaws are doing and are kind of culturally celebrated for is pretty much what businesses do, but they kind of normalize or naturalize it. Yeah. So I guess the whole book was about edges in that sense, you know, the edge between the formal and the informal economy.
Yeah. No, I think these ideas are really helpful. I mean, in my work, I find if you just kind of do research within the closed systems of business school and management thinking, you only go so far. You know, it's like the Harvard business case study. You know, they just study internal organizations as if they're kind of closed systems and don't realize the impact of social change on the outside, technological change coming in. And it's very kind of limited way of thinking. And I think to go to these edges and look at pirates, anarchists, trying to find different ways in to understand what's going on now by looking awry, you know, looking differently.
I think it's really important. And ways, you know, one of the jobs of educators in general, I think, is to kind of help people to see the world differently. Yeah. So that means that finding interesting ways of presenting particular sorts of ideas is crucial. So, you know, when I talk to students, I mean, I've got this talk I give sometimes called Captain Jack Sparrow and the Business School. So I start off with the Pirates of the Caribbean films and then try and convince them that this has something to do with business school education. And that worked quite nicely, you know, because I'm starting where they are with something that interests them. And then hopefully getting them to reframe some of their common sense in some quite different ways. So absolutely, I agree. You know, in a way, the odder the examples, the better.
No, it brings it to life, it animates it, because otherwise it's just kind of same old. So thank you for your work. It's very, very cool, Martin. I enjoy reading it.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Simon. You're so nice to me.
Before you jump off, I usually ask guests a question at the end, which is, what do you think helps us to live a good life, and what can help us create a good society? Just have your thoughts on that before you...
Two massive questions, aren't they? I mean, I suppose you could answer that in two very different ways, depending on whether you're understanding it as a kind of a personal issue or as a more social structural issue. But let me just try and connect them a bit, because it does seem to me that one of the features of our social order is that it very often allows us to disclaim responsibility for things. And on a personal level, we'd usually say that was bad, wouldn't we? That, you know, people who take responsibility for their actions are people who are good, who are virtuous, who are ethical in some way. But we live in a social order in which the responsibility for action is very often routinely disclaimed by organizations, by politicians, by institutions, and so on. So I guess there's something there for me about trying to understand what it means to take responsibility, both as an individual, you know, for your kids, for your community, for your job, whatever it might be, but also at a much wider level for... say, for example, you know, the British state and its responsibilities to generations to come. And unless it does those kinds of things, unless we can change our social structures so they do think about, you know, the generations to come, then we're not going to get very far in addressing climate change.
I'm 100% with you, Martin. Listen, it's been fabulous talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks ever so much, Simon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.